The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
A major cultural arts destination for visitors to Madrid, Spain, is the renowned Museo del Prado, or Prado Museum. As with any comparably large and venerable museum, the interior space of the Prado might leave you feeling that you've moved through a space-time warp. Once inside one of these palatial shrines of Europe, you sense that you've left the hubbub of the city and entered an unusually static space where nothing moves. Life is frozen, and even the most dynamic scenes of the most dynamic paintings have acquired a statuesque permanence. Don't be fooled. The artworks of the Prado have their origin in real life, in vibrant and dynamic experiences of people who, for whatever reason, most probably because they're dead, are no longer here to tell about them. Reviving those lives, those stories, is in part what a museum is about. We'll raise the dead in today's conversation about the Prado on today's Thinking Aloud. Gabriele Finaldi was born in London in 1965. After schooling in Italy and England, he completed his university studies at the Courtauld Institute of Art, London University, with a doctoral dissertation on Spanish painter Giuseppe de Ribera, who died in 1652. In 1992, Finaldi was appointed curator of later Italian and Spanish painting at the National Gallery, London, where he has organized several major exhibitions. Among these, in 1995, the exhibition Spanish Still Life from Velázquez to Goya, and in 1997, Discovering the Italian Baroque, the Dennis Mann Collection. Gabriele Finaldi curated the exhibition Orazio Gentileschi at the court of Charles I, which was shown in London, Bilbao, and in the Museo del Prado in Madrid in 1999. In the millennial year 2000, he curated, together with director Neil McGregor, the National Gallery exhibition titled Seeing Salvation, the Image of Christ, which attracted widespread interest and astonishing attendance figures. 2003-2004, we find Finaldi co-curating a major retrospective on El Greco, organized by the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the National Gallery, London. In 2002, he was appointed Deputy Director of Collections and Research at the Museo del Prado in Madrid and has overseen the opening of the museum's new extension, designed by architect Rafael Moneo, which was inaugurated in 2007, as well as an ambitious program of exhibitions and acquisitions. Finaldi has published extensively on Italian and Spanish painting of the 17th and 18th centuries and is currently working on an exhibition about Murillo's artistic relationship with Don Justino de Neve, the Seville Cathedral canon, and on display of Victorian painting from the collection of the Museum of Fine Arts in Ponce, Puerto Rico. I want to mention, finally, he's the editor of the Boletín del Museo del Prado, the official publication of the Prado Museum Bulletin. Gabriele Finaldi, pleasure to welcome you to Thinking Aloud.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Joining us for this conversation, somebody with far more expertise than I on today's subject, is John Rosenberg, currently serving as Dean of the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University. After graduating from BYU in psychology and Spanish, he went on to complete a PhD at Cornell University. That was in 1985, same year in which he came to BYU to teach full-time his degree at Cornell in Spanish literature. He specializes in 19th and 20th century Spanish literature and has had more than 40 opportunities to travel to Spain to conduct research in his field. In recent years, John Rosenberg has turned his attention to connections between Spanish literature and the Spanish visual art. John Rosenberg, welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin with John describing, actually, your acquaintance with Gabriele Finaldi. And tell us how you got to know each other and in what sort of situations, because this goes back a few years.
Yes, Gabriele and I met 4 or 5 years ago. Have been working through the National Endowment for the Humanities to take American teachers to Spain to study precisely the relationships between literature and visual arts, and we wanted the Prado to be our classroom. And Gabriele was extremely generous, has been extremely generous in working with us, providing access to the collections in some very privileged ways, and in making available to us some of his colleagues and the curatorial staff to provide lectures and additional information for our students. So he has been a great friend to me personally and to the university.
Give us, if you would, Gabriele Finaldi, some sense, for those of us who've never set foot in this museum, what to expect. What's the scope of the collection, and what meets me as I walk in the front door?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I envy enormously those who've never been to the Prado, because I know that they'll have an extraordinary experience when they first visit. When you visit the Prado, what you really get is an experience of the great tradition of European painting, and especially Spain's contribution to it, because Spain, of course, is the Prado is, of course, the National Museum of Spain. So you find there extensive collections of works by the great Spanish artists, by Velázquez, by Murillo, and by Goya, of course, El Greco and Ribera, all those great Spanish artists. But, of course, being the collection it is, having been formed by the rulers of Spain over several centuries, it's a collection which was much more wide-ranging than that. There are great collections of Italian art. There are great collections of Flemish art in particular. There's also very important collections of ancient Roman art. What we lack at the Prado, and we're quite conscious of it, is we don't have, for example, great Dutch collections or great British collections. But that, of course, reflects the nature of the historical relationship between Spain and those countries, which more often than not, they were at war. But the experience of visiting the Prado, I think, is a memorable experience for anyone who comes. And sure enough, to stand in front of Las Meninas by Velázquez, or to stand in front of the great pictures by Titian, is, I think, an unforgettable experience for anyone, whether they're art historian professionals or simply visiting members of the public.
So if somebody has been to one of the major museums in other European capitals, if you've been to London, or if you've been to Vienna's Kunsthistorisches Museum, that sort of a thing, we could expect the kind of collection that was put together initially by people of means, great means, the royal or ruling families, and so that would represent sort of an eclectic mix of art from across the continent and perhaps even beyond?
Yeah, essentially the collection is formed by a group of individuals who have had the means and the contacts to form a very, very important collection. The Prado is not a collection formed by professional art historians, so it very much reflects the taste of the Habsburg monarchs, essentially Charles V, Philip II in the 16th century, Philip IV in the 17th century, and then some of the later Bourbon monarchs right up to the 19th century. It's different from a collection like, I don't know, a collection that your listeners might know, like the Met, for example, which is a collection essentially formed by specialist art historians, or even the London National Gallery, for that matter, a collection formed by art professionals. No, the Prado collection, like, let's say, the Uffizi, or even the Louvre, is a collection formed by rulers, several of which had an extraordinary passion for collecting.
One last question before I defer to John Rosenberg and let him join in the conversation, too. Has there been, at the Prado, extending now in more modern times, extending into collections where it's driven more by art historians and collectors rather than the wealthy patrons? Is that the direction it goes now with new acquisitions or more recent acquisitions?
Well, one of the extraordinary things about the Prado is that in its early years, at the very beginning of the 19th century, it was directed or governed by aristocrats. From the 1830s onwards, it's directed by painters. So painters have always played an important role in the functioning of the museum. And in fact, curiously enough, the museum was run by painters until 1960, not 1860, 1960. And it's only really after 1960 that professional art historians become directors of the Museo del Prado. So it's really from the 1960s that the museum starts becoming a more modern museum, or a more scientific museum, you might say, in the sense that collections begin to be studied more profoundly. You have professional art historians brought in as curators of the collection. And so the collection is presented and studied in a different way from the way it had been before, where it was really the treasure house of the Spanish monarchy.
Following up on your indication of the origin of the real energy for the museum being with the Spanish royal family and thinking about that whole political context for the creation of the collection. We've just come through a magnificent electoral season here in the United States. And like most of those seasons, visual images play an important part in communicating messages that the candidates are trying to get across. What many of us may not realize is that images have always come out of political context, and that is certainly the case in the collection of the Prado Museum. Could you talk a little bit about not just the aesthetic traditions that are framed within the museum, but also the political context?
Yeah, I think it's a crucial element of the Prado's collection that so much of its painting, so much of its imagery, is tied to the way in which particularly the Habsburgs, but later the Bourbons too, wanted to present themselves. So there's a very significant collection of portraits, for example. That's a fairly straightforward thing to say, but all the kings of Spain and the queens of Spain wanted their portraits painted in order to be able to project a certain kind of image of themselves. Titian, of course, the Venetian painter, although he never travelled to Spain, was responsible, together with a painter from the Netherlands called Antonius Moore, in the mid-16th century, in really establishing what the Spanish monarchy looked like. Not so much their physical appearance, that's an important part of it also, but really about how they projected themselves to the outside world. Portraits of the Spanish rulers were sent around all the European courts, and of course, from a distance, what you saw was not the person itself. You saw their portrait. You saw a very austerely dressed monarch, a monarch who stood alone, who usually held a piece of paper, a petition, a letter in their hand. So you saw them at work. You saw them receiving visitors, ambassadors, and so on. But they have a sort of hieratic appearance. They are distant figures, but obviously concerned with the good of and the well-being of their kingdoms. Also, the Prado has a lot of political imagery because this is the kind of painting, other than portraiture, that the royals of Spain commissioned. I'm thinking, for example, of the great battle scenes that were commissioned by Philip IV, for example, for his new royal palace, the Palacio de Buen Retiro, in the 1630s, where the king is anxious to display the military victories of his regime, not only in Spain, but in fact way beyond, right out to Brazil, to Italy, to Germany, and so on. So the image making which is being done under the Habsburgs and the Bourbons is all about projecting a certain concept of what the monarchy is, what it wants to achieve, what it wants others to think of it.
Would those types of paintings, the portraits and the battle scenes, have reached their intended audience? And if so, do we know anything about the effect that those paintings would have had on that audience? Would it have gone to an audience that had access to them even in the first place?
Well, access was much more limited, obviously, than it is today. Essentially, the kinds of images that were produced, or the portraits that were produced of the Spanish royal family, could be seen in the royal palace itself. They could be seen in embassies in different capital cities. Lower down, if you like, there were all kinds of images that were made to be kept in religious convents or in aristocratic families, suites of portraits of the Spanish royal family. So certainly somebody like Charles V, his image would have been very familiar throughout Europe because it was a kind of image that was much, much repeated.
Could we go back to your reference to the palace that Philip IV builds with his prime minister, the Conde Duque de Olivares, in the Hall of Realms in the Retiro Palace in the first third of the 17th century. That room had a very carefully designed political program that included pictures of a cycle of Hercules paintings by Zurbarán, a dozen battle scenes, and very important portraits of the current king and queen, his parents, and his son. Can you describe what that grouping of paintings was designed to portray about the crown?
Well, from the way you've described it, it's perfectly clear that there's a dynastic element to that decorative program. You know, this is a succession of different kings. The Habsburg family guarantees its commitment to the state and its continuity in the state. But not only the state, but the empire, because, of course, at this time, you know, the empire of which it was first said the sun never set was the Spanish Empire, well before the British Empire. And so those battle scenes that are shown in the Hall of Realms are battles fought during the 1620s and 1630s. So within the reign of Philip IV himself, he's a very young king, remember, he comes to the throne at the age of 16 and adopts a very aggressive political and military policy towards his enemies, fundamentally, in Northern Europe. And those Northern European powers that were fighting the Spanish in the colonies in the Americas and so on. So the intention is to show that the Spanish forces are powerful. They can defend the state. They can defend the true religion. Of course, this is another thing that the king is very concerned to show. And this series of images of Hercules, which you referred to, Hercules is the mythical founder of the Habsburg royal family of Spain. So to show Hercules defeating all kinds of enemies, of course, is a kind of political allegory, which should be understood in relation to Philip IV and his own predecessors, and indeed those who will come after him, like his own son, who's represented in a marvelous equestrian portrait over one of the doors.
Projection of dynastic power and continuity, but at least two of the pictures in this series, one that was perhaps best known at the time by Maino on the surrender of the Dutch to the Spanish at Bahia in Brazil, the other that is now the more famous of the pair, Velázquez's surrender of Breda, also known as Las Lanzas, are projecting a different sense of political power. Can you describe the difference between the way power is depicted in those paintings compared to the others in the series?
Mm. Well, very interestingly, these are the two images that don't actually show, strictly speaking, a battle at all. The first picture you mentioned by a monk painter called Juan Bautista Maino shows the Dutch forces who have been defeated at Bahia in Brazil. They're kneeling before an image of the king, so they're recognizing that they owe their lives really to the clemency of the Spanish king, and so they kneel before him. But very interestingly, in the foreground of that picture, what Maino shows, and it may be to do with his religious background, I imagine that has a lot to do with it, you actually see women and elderly men taking care of the wounded. So there's a sense in which battles are necessary, but not necessarily good. And battles, of course, lead to loss, and they lead to death, and they lead to injury. And it's necessary to take care of those who are injured. And this is very much a concern in the foreground of this picture. In the other picture, the famous Surrender of Breda by Velázquez, what you see is the moment where the Spanish general has got off his horse and receives the keys of the city of Breda from the Dutch general who has been holding out against the Spanish forces in a rather long-lasting siege. And there, once again, it's a very interesting detail. You see the Spanish general actually putting his arm onto the back of the Dutch general. He's actually got off his horse. In other words, he's showing enormous respect towards the enemy he's just defeated. And this is a quality which the Spaniards felt was very important for them to project, that they were noble warriors, that they recognized the valor of their enemies, but in the end, they were superior.
Yes, in fact, the posture of that particular painting is eerily reminiscent of the conventional postures of visitation paintings, of Mary greeting Elizabeth, who bends her knee ever so slightly as the Virgin reaches out to grasp her. And so by making that connection with this biblical scene, it reinforces that whole notion of the mercy and the clemency of the Spanish crown, which perhaps is an part of an institutional response against the propaganda of the black legend that was going on at the time.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's also true that you mentioned religious painting. I think religious painting is always in the background for Spanish painters. So the kind of imagery that you see even in non-religious painting, I think, is heavily influenced, whether it's in the composition or the kind of emotions that are represented, or, as you say, in the very poses that the figures adopt. So let's say that the matrix for all secular painting in 17th century Spain, I think, is ultimately religious painting.
On Thinking Aloud today, we're visiting with Gabriele Finaldi, the Deputy Director of Collections and Research at the Prado Museum in Madrid, and joining also with us the Dean of the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, John Rosenberg. John.
Earlier we were talking about the National Museum and the fact that the collection of the Prado was very much a reflection of the collectionist tendencies of the Spanish kings, particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries. But you also mentioned a couple of names that are very internationalist. Titian, who would have come into the Spanish sphere of influence out of Venice. Rubens, who comes to Madrid on a couple of occasions as a diplomat, which, again, as we think about the political context, there is that tension between nationalism and internationalism. Can you reflect on how that played out in terms of the current collection of the Prado and in terms of the policy of collecting in the 16th and 17th centuries?
Yeah, these are very international figures. Titian is really the great superstar of 16th century painting, if I can put it that way. He works from Venice, so he's working in the Venetian Republic, which is a non-aligned independent state. It's close to Spain. But he never actually travels to Spain, although a great deal of his painterly production, particularly from the 1540s onwards, is done for the Spanish crown. This is why in the Prado today we have the largest collection anywhere, even more than in Venice, of pictures by Titian. We have nearly 50 paintings by Titian there. So Titian is recognized as the greatest painter of the age, and the Spanish Habsburgs are interested in harnessing his skills and his abilities and his fame too, I have to say, in order to project the kind of image that they want projected of themselves. With Rubens, we have a different situation. Rubens is actually a subject of the Spanish crown. He's born in he operates in Flanders, which is part of the Spanish crown. He's in the service of the Spanish monarchy, and he uses his painterly talents to serve the political ends of the Spanish crown. But Rubens is an interesting figure because he also acts, as you say, as a diplomat. He travels widely around Europe. He's particularly involved in the late 1620s in trying to establish a peace between Charles I's England and Philip IV's Spain, which at this period were in conflict. So Rubens plays a role which goes beyond that of simply providing imagery, portraiture or religious imagery for the ruling heads of Europe. He's actually active in seeking to bring conflictual situations to an end. And all these elements are very apparent as you walk around the Prado. You're very conscious of tensions between different European states and how the art is playing a part in these complex relationships, and sometimes helping to resolve them and sometimes hardening positions.
Speaking of those complex relationships, thinking about the difficult historical relationships between England and Spain, and you mentioned the case of Charles I, can you describe for us the rather interesting tale of Charles I's initial experience with Spain and then the magnificent estate sale that took place after his execution?
Well, Charles I, as a young man, is absolutely fascinated by Spain, and he's fascinated by the young Philip IV and his great prestige and his great importance as a European monarch. And at a certain point, he decides that he wants to go to Spain and strike a deal with the king in order to marry his sister. So they travel off, he and the young Duke of Buckingham. They travel incognito on horseback. They cross the Channel and make their way through France and down to Madrid. They arrive rather unexpectedly and cause a great diplomatic hoo-ha. The Spaniards are simply not expecting them. There is a complication, of course, and that is that Charles I is a Protestant prince. Philip IV is the defender of the Catholic faith in Europe. And so the Spaniards, on the one hand, are keen to establish good relations with the young Charles. On the other hand, they're not very keen that there should be a marriage match between a Protestant prince and a Catholic princess. In the end, it comes to nothing, but Charles does go away from Madrid, having discovered that what can make you a really great king is collecting art. And he admires the collections in Madrid and goes back to London thinking that he wants to be a king just like Philip IV. And that's when he begins collecting himself, acquiring works from Venice, engaging Van Dyck as painter to the court. Sadly, of course, it all comes to a nasty end when, after the English Civil War, Charles I is put to death and his collection is put on sale. Now, Philip IV is very anxious to acquire some of the great works from cousin Charles's collection, although he doesn't want it to be seen that he's profiting from the death of his distant relative. So he uses various forms of agents in order to acquire some of these works. They're never being obviously acquired for him, but many of the important works do end up in the king's collection and consequently in the Prado.
We have about a minute left. Perhaps we could jump to the future, to your own work as a curator of shows. A few years ago, you did a show called Scene Salvation, The Image of Christ, which may be of interest to our listeners, because at about the same time, the BYU Museum of Art did a show called Beholding Salvation. Can you describe for us briefly what the narrative line of was of your show?
Well, what we thought at that time was so many of our pictures in our national collections, in our public museums, are religious art. And so many of our works which have been removed from their original contexts, they're always studied as works which are representative of a certain element of art history or a certain current in stylistic history. We thought we really wanted to focus them as religious works of art, to try and somehow get to their original meaning. And so we did an exhibition based largely on the National Gallery's own holdings in which we focused on the religious content of these works. And what was really remarkable was the public response. It was one of the most visited exhibitions we have ever had in London. Over 400,000 visitors saw it. And the astonishing thing was all the kinds of people who don't normally come to galleries of old master painting came to see this exhibition. I think they found things which they didn't expect to find and were very pleasing and satisfying for
and
them.
And from what I've heard, there were some people who actually felt that they had entered into religious space rather than into a secular museum.
It was very curious to find people praying in an exhibition. It was very curious at one point to see an Anglican bishop who was visiting. A young man approached him and asked if the bishop would give him a blessing. Well, there, that happened in front of a Piero della Francesca. It's not the kind of thing we're used to, but I certainly saw it as a very good thing.
We're going to have to leave it right there, but I want to thank both of you for participating today. Gabriele Finaldi, thanks for joining and visiting with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
And John Rosenberg of the College of Humanities Dean there, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guest today on Thinking Aloud, Gabriele Finaldi, Deputy Director for Collections and Research at the Prado Museum in Madrid. We hope you come to our website from time to time and listen to any of our past interviews if you can. Remember that we're online at classical89.org/thinkingaloud. We have an archive of everything we've done to date. We invite you to tune in for future programs. We're on the air weekdays at 11 o'clock with repeat broadcasts at 8, with the exception of Tuesdays when we bring you a BYU devotional or forum broadcast. On our production team, the following individuals, Wes Sims and Koyo Iyamba, and BYU students Anna Staker and Brent Rowland. Our theme music is by BYU graduate student Nicholas Greer. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Thinking Aloud.
Thinking Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.